Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. And today we're going to return to a theme that we first introduced on our November 20th Alternative Visions show. You can visit that online at the archive on Progressive Radio Network, or you can also go and revisit that at alternativevisions.podbean.com. That's podbean.com. Alternative Visions, all one word, .podbean.com, or on the Progressive Radio Network's archive. Okay, that topic, a November 20th show, we're going to return to today, which is American labor, that is the American unions, not just the entire working class, at a strategic impasse. A strategic dead end, if you want to be less polite about it. What we mean by that is, are the strategies of U.S. labor, the unions, of recent decades, at least since the 1990s, now delivering so poorly that one can argue that these strategies have, in effect, failed? What are these strategies? And do they need a fundamental working over, restructuring? By strategies, I mean three categories. One political strategy is the political strategy of organized labor now pretty much failed. That strategy, of course, being tie yourself increasingly, as the crisis deepens, to the Democratic Party for concessions from it, in exchange for which the unions provide hundreds of millions of dollars for elections and countless more in terms of in-kind assistance, in other words, people on the ground. Okay, political strategy, industrial strategy, collective bargaining, is it failing? Not as an institution, but the strategy with relation to it. If we look at since the 1990s, that's industrial strategy, bargaining strategy has been pretty much focusing on what's called maintenance of benefits. In other words, unions have been given up wages and concessions and other contract language and other to enable to hold on to their health care and pensions, particularly health care. And now is that strategy coming to a dead end as we get increasing revisions, political revisions of the healthcare system in the U.S., which means union workers continually lose out, pay more, get less. Organizing, another aspect of industrial strategy. Is that succeeding or failing? And then, of course, we can talk about strikes, boycotts, other tactics as part of industrial strategy. Finally, a social community strategy. Have the American unions adopted the right approach to community groups and alliances? Okay, so three strategy dimensions, political, industrial, social, community. My guest today, follow-up guest I had 2 weeks ago, who were longtime unionists, like Steve Early, a four-decade-long member of the Communication Workers of America and author of several books on unions. If you're interested in that interview, go back to November 20th and listen to that, and Arun Gupta, who was also interviewed. Now, today's guests are also longtime, very experienced union leaders, Jerry Gordon and Alan Benjamin. They also each have more than four decades of experience. Jerry is the former, now retired, representative for the United Food Commercial Workers. He is also secretary of the Emergency Labor Network and the Labor Fight Back Network, formed a couple years ago, which has been doing some yeoman work on trying to encourage labor to move in a new direction. Alan Benjamin is also a longtime union activist and leader, a delegate to the San Francisco Central Labor Council for a number of years, member of OPEIU, and also a member of the ELN. Both have been involved in labor organizing, community alliances, bargaining strikes, and so forth, too numerous to mention here. 4 decades of impeccable credentials as people who have been deep into the labor movement for a long time, and they've seen the transformation going on over the decades. The purpose of today's interview is to continue the dialogue with experienced grassroots union leaders we started a couple weeks ago, who have witnessed the fundamental transformation of unions in the U.S. from the 1970s, when unions and leaders still fought back, and folks probably don't remember, but 1970-71 was one of the biggest strike waves in U.S. history, only exceeded by the post-World War II strike wave, 1946. 1970-71, when unions, major unions, were winning, listen to this, folks, first-year wage and benefit increases in three-year contracts of 20%. Yes, construction unions, the auto workers, longshore workers, steel workers, they were winning 20% wage and benefit increases in 1970-71 in the biggest strike wave in modern history in the U.S. Successful. The corporations couldn't stop them. That's why they brought in Richard Nixon and the wage freeze. And then they had a big inflation, and then they had a big recession. And ever since then, labor has gone into remission here. Okay, ever since the 1980s to the present, we've been witnessing a deterioration. So what's gone wrong, fundamentally? Is it just a question of more aggressive corporations? Yes, yes, that's part of it. Is it the Democratic Party abandoning labor and the social contract? Yeah. Is it the failure of union leadership? Has the character of union leadership changed? Finally, is it a question of strategy? One final comment. We're going to follow up today's show with further interviews on this topic in the next few weeks. Next week, we will have a longtime experienced activist, Ray Rogers, who will be talking with us on the same theme. But we want to pick the brains here of Jerry and Alan on those three fundamental categories of union strategy. What's gone wrong? No, what's gone right? I'm not saying everything's wrong, but I think labor really needs to look at hard, is the path that's been followed for the last 2 decades clearly not producing results? On the organizing side, last year, 2012, labor lost 500,000 members while the economy gained 1.5 million jobs. What's gone wrong? First time that ever happened. Usually labor membership rises and falls a bit with the economy, but now they're going in opposite directions. And some of the biggest losses have been in the public sector. On the bargaining side, industrial strategy, maintenance of benefits has hit a dead end. After 20 years of giving up wages to protect their health care, what we got now is the government, under the Obamacare Act, pretty much taking away what has been achieved in terms of maintenance of benefits. Unions in particular, in the next few years, by 2018, already begun, that'll be the end of union-negotiated health care plans, because the Obamacare Act calls for a 40% excise tax on union-negotiated plans. Of course, wage concessions continue. And on the political side, well, do I have to say much about that? I mean, labor has received nothing from the Obama administration except a few token appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. That's it. Political strategy is perhaps the most obvious failure in labor's general strategic orientation. Organizing, workers want to organize everywhere. In the South, low wages and so forth, but unions can't seem to get their hands around that as a strategy and how to respond to that. Community? Well, they talked about community alliances. They were going to do something about bringing community groups into the FLCO in a recent convention. Oh, but they backed off of that one, too. Okay, so I've said enough. I've had my say. This is the introduction. Alan, you there?
Yes, I am.
How about you, Jerry? You there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having
me. Well, we're going to get some real good commentary, I'm sure. These two guys have been around a long time. They've seen it all. They have grassroots, on-the-ground experience at various levels. I can't think of two better people to interview about this. Let's take the whole question of bargaining strategy, industrial strategy, bargaining and organizing. Jerry, you want to take that up? What's gone wrong here? Why are we going backwards? And why are we now at a dead end? We're giving wage concessions, and now they're taking away our benefits. What's going on?
Well, Jack, Alan and I have worked out a scenario, and I will focus on political strategy and its failings, and he's going to commit to discussing this what you just raised. So,
okay.
Alan, why don't you start it off?
Okay, Alan, take it up.
Well, first, I think it's important to note, Jack, that the labor strategy did work in the post-war period up until the 70s, at a time when the economy was growing, when before the big crisis of the entire world capitalist system hit, before Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard, the recessions began to kick in. But the traditional support, you know, the Democratic Party, the alliances between labor and the Democrats worked. You could expect a 4% wage increase and overall improvement of your health care or benefits package. It was a period of guns and butter, but that came crashing down. It came to an end, and the labor movement didn't adjust. They were used to their sweetheart deals. A labor officialdom that had grown fat, sort of with the privileges that come with the bigger contracts, golden parachutes if there were any kinds of layoffs or whatever. But all of that came crashing down, as you have pointed out so many times, at the end of the 70s and 80s. Corporations began to move, whipsawing workers in one area against another. You saw the beginning of the free trade agreements and globalization, and on the plant level, workers were told, you've got to make some concessions here, otherwise the companies are going to pick up and leave. And you saw the beginning of the labor management partnerships agreement in auto. You saw labor officials sitting on the board of the corporate boards, in the case of Chrysler, and labor just hoping against hope that things would be okay if they made these concessions, if they made these adjustments. After all, they could make up for these in the next contract. But the companies picked up, went off to Mexico, went off to Korea, went off to China, even after all the concessions were made. So the whole period of concession bargaining didn't save jobs. It saw the massive destruction of jobs, the Rust Belt, and that continues till this day. Take the case of workers in Boeing up in the state of Washington. The corporation wants to build these huge number of the Boeing 777s. And they demanded that the union reopen the contract. Huge concessions being demanded to a new two-tier. All the new hires have to work twice as long to reach maximum pay level. They had to take cuts in benefits, cuts in wages, and a no strike pledge. This is also new. And they had to do this for an extended contract up to 2022. Failure to do that, they were told, would mean that the company would pick up or build these Boeings in South Carolina or Missouri or elsewhere. The workers, the union leadership, as it has been doing everywhere, just buckled to this pressure. Oh, no, we don't want them to leave. Give them what they want. That's the whole issue of partnership. The idea that what's good for the company, what's good for GM, to go or Ford, to go back to the old days, is good for workers. That's such a hoax, and that's the fundamental problem that really is at the root of all the political and organizing and union strategy, the concept, the failure to assert labor's independence at the shop floor, on organizing, at the political level. And so the officials accepted the contract, but the members voted it down, said the company is rolling in money. It's got the biggest tax exemptions and concessions made by the state of Washington to keep them there, and they're just greedy. And they voted down the contract against the union leaders, the local and district and state and national IAM, and by 67%. And now they're being told that they have to go back and vote right, otherwise the company is going to move. And the company is making every effort to say we're going to go. The officials are scurrying, hoping to get politicians to give more tax exemptions. And now labor is being pitted against each other. Labor in South Carolina is being told, you know, we want to work with the state officials to give more concessions and bring Boeing here. And we're being pitted against each other. So at a certain point, and this is where Labor Fight Back Network and others come in, is we have to build solidarity. We have to say that the union mandate, that vote has to be respected. Labor movement has to rise to the occasion and build solidarity with these workers and say the companies can't leave by any means necessary. Strike, use of eminent domain to keep them from leaving, whatever, by whatever means necessary, because if not, labor is going to continue to go down and down and down, as you have noted in your introduction. So independence, independent action, mobilization, fight back, and saying no to labor management partnerships. That's at the root of the problems with organizing, with the failure to organize. So I'll turn it over to Jerry here. To you, Jeff.
Well, before we move on to Jerry and the politics of this, because obviously that's looming large, let's continue with this case of Boeing here. You know, clearly the higher elements in the machinist union are attempting to get their friends, the Democrats, to help them here. I don't think they're going to get much help, but that's a topic for Jerry. But, you know, let's go back to this. You're pretty much saying, Alan, that it's this joint cooperation and partnerships that has been a trend since the 80s that has poisoned the well of bargaining and the ability to strike, along with the threat of offshoring, right, or outsourcing, so forth, right?
Absolutely.
So can you elaborate on that? I mean, do you really think it's joint partnership that is causing the decline of bargaining effectiveness, or is the decline of bargaining effectiveness leading labor to make more concessions in joint partnership?
I mean, they go hand in hand. The companies are playing rough, saying, you don't give us the concessions, we leave. So the union says we're going to give you what you want, but please stay. They don't stay, and so it weakens labor's hand. Labor continues to get weaker and weaker, has less of a at least with this kind of strategy, less clout, less ability to exert any economic leverage, let alone strike. They accept no strike pledges. They accept the concessions, and concessions just beget more concessions.
So what you're saying, if I can paraphrase you again, is that union leadership has chosen the path of let's make concessions rather than the path of, you know, let's duke it out with these guys. And if you're going to duke it out, then, you know, what's wrong with the strike strategy? I mean, is it not community-oriented enough? Is that the issue? Are they afraid of the laws, which have made it much more difficult to strike and which have a greater threat of we're going to take over your local, we're going to take your funding, we're going to put you in jail, et cetera? Is that the reason
I think it's two things.
The concession route?
I think the failure, well, the laws, first of all, are a real issue. We have the right to strike in this country on paper only. In reality, there's so many impediments and so many legal and other impediments through Taft-Hartley that right doesn't really exist. So you have to go up against the state. You have to take on the powers that be and say that no matter what, you're going to, you may have to violate laws if you're going to have a picket line that's a real picket line and you don't have to let the scabs cross, because what is a strike but the ability to withhold labor? You can strike, but you can't withhold labor if you can't keep people from crossing your picket line. So the legal framework, so challenging that, and then the fact that often you do strike and then they leave. So you have the whole globalization on the one hand, and then these laws, and the unwillingness of labor to challenge them and say, the only way we're going to win is if we challenge unjust laws, and we're going to build a solidarity that's going to make it impossible for these corporations to leave.
Well, but let me play devil's advocate again. Leave, yes. Manufacturing can move. Light manufacturing can move easier. But, you know, 80% of the economy, actually more than that, if you include construction, 88%, is not manufacturing. And yet we see the same failures or inability or reluctance to fight, unless the rank and file break through and say, we don't care, we're going to fight, as we've seen in a couple of cases here and there, like in Chicago with the teachers and so forth. But 88% of the economy is not movable. And yet we see the same strategic problems that have arisen. Let me throw this out to you. Is it that the idea of strike and fight is too limited, that it's not broad enough to consider other elements and allies in society that could help? We know that if you got a contract, the limitation on picketing is significant. But if you're not a member of the union, if you're a worker center, or if you're a community organization, or so forth, the labor laws don't apply to you. I'm just playing devil's advocate here, and you know, because they can move, that shouldn't be the end of the game. What do you think?
Well, really quickly, because I know Jerry has a lot to say as well. I would just say this: the community peace is extremely important. For too long, labor has gone it alone, hasn't built alliances, hasn't built support among the public, especially in the public sector unions. And so the bosses and the media and big business has been able to project the public sector as this privileged sector and the poor unorganized workers having to pay the cost of supporting these public sector workers. Obviously, that is a key component. The labor movement has made a shift toward community, which is an important one. I'll take issue with you on one thing you said in your introduction. It's not that the labor movement rejected community alliances. I think labor was correct in rejecting incorporating the communities onto the leadership bodies and as members of the unions, because that would dissolve the union character, the working class character, to bring in community organizations to make them full-fledged members and brought on to the leadership bodies of the unions. What they did do, is to say we want to build alliances, labor community alliances, and that was correct. The problem is that a lot of these alliances are carried out very much within the confines of what's acceptable to the Democratic Party. So a labor immigrant rights alliance was created, but only with those immigrant rights organizations that supported a Senate bill that was really not a pro-immigrant bill. And those community organizations that had been fighting that bill weren't invited to the table. So the issue of building alliances with the community doesn't resolve it. It has to be alliances, yes, but toward what end? And then that comes in again, the independent organizing.
Well, if I can just comment on your comment, and I think probably you and I have a little bit of a different view here. The way I viewed the recent convention and the backing off of the original statement by AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka earlier this year that let's bring community organizations, bona fide organizations, into the AFL-CIO on a more formal structured basis, he threw that idea up, and Building Trades and some other unions shot it down because they don't want their votes diluted on the AFL-CIO Executive Council. But boy, they sure need some new blood and some new thinking, in my view, up there. And it was pretty much shut down, if I can get my interpretation. And now we're back to where we were, largely, in terms of labor community alliances, where labor is kind of hands-off. You know, we support you in word only and so forth, and maybe we'll do a little tepid action here or there and vice versa. It's more of an alliance in name only, and maybe political lobbying together. That's really what's been done up to now. But in my view, I think we've got to unleash the grassroots here and mix union represented workers with other workers, because it's the working class where you talk about the community alliances and community, where they can fight and support each other at the grassroots and their grassroots struggle. But anyway, that's just my take on this, and I'm sure we'll discuss it some more. But let's open it to Jerry. Jerry, you've been listening to us on these issues for the next 5 minutes until we take a break, then we'll come back and pick it up again with you. Run with it.
Yes, I've been listening attentively, and I certainly want to underscore everything Alan has said, and you, Jack, and you'll have to work out the difference. But I want to concentrate on the political strategy, and let me preface it by saying my purpose is to capsulize a lot of the thinking that one can find spelled out at our website, which is laborfightback.org. We hope you will visit your listeners, laborfightback.org, because we do address all the questions you've been talking about in the course of this discussion. Now, in the 68 years since World War II, we have seen every combination as far as Democrats and Republicans in the government. One party will have the White House and both houses of Congress, and then the other will have the White House and both houses of Congress. And then you have divided government, which is the claim we have today, although we feel both parties are corporate parties. But symbolically, at least, we have two parties, and they divide the government with the Democrats in the White House and dominating in the Senate and the Republicans in the House. And no matter what the combination was, no matter what the situation was, the labor movement, because of its strategy of subservience to the Democrats, has gotten virtually nothing. Even after spending hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to elect candidates who forget about them the day after the election, ignore them, or compromise away and dilute labor's program. So as Alan has emphasized, what is needed basically is an independent labor movement that has a voice together with its community partners. And until that occurs, sadly, it appears that these defeats will just continue and even multiply. I want to elaborate very briefly some of the dismal setbacks. One is the jobs program. Labor stands for a full employment economy and a big infrastructure program, public works, and so on. Put everybody back to work. And the Obama administration, supported by labor, has the American Jobs Act, which at best will give jobs, create jobs for 1 to 2 million workers. This underscores the inadequacy. And so there's no real struggle by labor now for its program. It's left with almost nothing on the number one issue before the working class. Then take labor law reform, which would restore, at least in part, labor's right to strike, which has been stricken, basically, rendered powerless. Nothing more important than you can't stop scabs and strike breakers from entering a struck plant or workplace because of injunctions being issued. We'll get to that in a minute, the Taft-Hartley Act. And then there's the Employee Free Choice Act. Well, this has been projected under Clinton, under Obama, Democrats. Obama had a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate. He was committed to it. What has happened to it? Nobody hears anything about it. He never lifted a finger to bring it about. That's the Card Check Act. And then there's no fight for the single-payer health care. True, the AFL-CIO passed unanimously a resolution endorsing a single-payer, which they reaffirmed at Los Angeles. But they went along with the Affordable Care Act, which has been a bludgeon on labor, which is now widely opposed within the ranks of labor, not for Tea Party reasons, but because it turns over the centrality of the health care system, or it perpetuates it, to the insurance companies. And one other thing is the Taft-Hartley Act, passed in 1947. This was, in a sense, the post-World War II opening gun in the all-out assault to weaken labor. And it has taken a terrific toll. Now, keep in mind that a majority of Democrats in Congress at the time voted in favor of Taft-Hartley. In fact, they had to overcome a Truman veto. So the question is, how can labor support a political party that passes the most repressive labor, anti-labor legislation maybe in history? And yet they go right on, and no matter how much you kick labor in the teeth, the leaders say, well, this is what we got to do. And it undermines organizing the South, and it caused even powerful unions problems in winning strikes. So this is the record. But I want to spend the rest of my time here on two issues, which are front and center, because I think that they expose in a really profound way the basic character of the Democratic Party as failing to represent workers. And the first of these is food stamps. What is happening to food stamps is contemptible and criminal. It started off without stirring too much the population or the labor movement on June 10th when the Senate, U.S. Senate, dominated by the Democrats, came out with a bill which they passed, you know, it's subject to reconciliation with the House version, to cut $4.1 billion in food stamp funding over 10 years. Every Democrat in the Senate voted for that bill, except for Jack Reed of Rhode Island. The Democrats were unanimous. Even when there was a motion to amend it, to restore the $4.1 billion because the committee dominated by the Democrats came in with that as part of its proposal. So they did propose an amendment, and it lost by a vote of 26 to 70. Only 26 Democrats in the Senate voted to restore the $4.1 billion. Now, a lot of people say in and out of the labor movement, well, not to worry. The Democrats have a majority. We have a majority. We have a majority in the Senate. We do not have a majority in the Senate. The Democratic Party has a majority in the Senate. we, defining we as the working class majority and our community partners, we don't have any kind of majority, and we don't have much of a voice. And the fact that only 26 U.S. senators said, no, don't cut food stamps, is really indicative. In any event, unfortunately, the AFL-CIO had nothing to say about this vote because of the subservience of the Democratic Party. Now, in September, 3 months later, House of Representatives voted, and they voted by 217 to 210 to cut food stamps by $39 billion over 10 years. And here, the leadership of the AFL-CIO roundly and properly condemned it. So now they're meeting in conference, and Debbie Stabenow, who is the head of the Agricultural Committee in the Senate, has already said, this just came out a day or two ago, that she's willing to go to $8 billion. She's just doubled it. How do you go into negotiations with the other side that wants a $39 billion cut with cuts of your own? What's going on here? And what they say is, well, we need to pass this bill because the farmers need it. I even talked to Bernie Sanders' office, to their staff person. It's a rural state, Vermont. They need it. Okay, pass it. But don't cut food stamps in the process. This country's flush with money. It's flush with money. And yet it showed that by the $12 trillion that were made available for the bailout of the banks and Wall Street. It's shown that it's ready to spend $50 billion to stay in Afghanistan for another 10 years after 2014. There's money for the rainbow tax, which is a tax on every stock and bond sold. There's the whole business of raising the corporate tax rate, which is 35% to 50%, which is what it once was. Obama wants to lower it to 28%. And keep in mind that those rates don't mean much anyway because the corporations get around them, and a lot of the big corporations pay nothing. I mean, this whole thing is contemptible. It's even criminal because children make up 50% of food stamp recipients, and you're taking food off of their plates, sending them to school without breakfast, with profound after effects, even if they survive childhood. In later life, health-wise. So,
well, let me interrupt you there briefly, Jerry. We'll come back because we need to take a break. But before we do, let me just say what I've been hearing from you two guys is what labor shouldn't be doing. What it's doing now is doing wrong. I want you to address the question, what should it do? It seems to be centering in your commentary around this question of independence. Alan talked about independence from labor management cooperation, which is holding us back on the industrial strategy, and you've been mentioning independence on the political from the Democratic Party. Okay, so if that's the problem, what's the solution? What does it mean to say independent action in terms of what new strategies should labor be undertaking to push independence? Okay, we're going to take a break and come back to that. Jerry, I want you to pick that up with regard to the political strategy. Should we break with the Democratic Party? What does that mean? And Alan, you know, what does it mean to say that we shouldn't have cooperation? Do we go it alone then? Okay, let's take a break and come back to that.
Now, sometimes tomorrow I'm soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood.
This is Jack Rasmus. We are back here with Alternative Visions, Jerry Gordon and Alan Benjamin. Jerry, let's pick up where we left off. You've given some very clear information about how, once again, with the food stamps, labor is taking it on the chin from the Democratic Party. After labor put this guy in office again in 2012, it was labor votes and community working class votes from key states, from Ohio, Michigan, Virginia, Colorado and elsewhere that put him over the top, and this is what we get in return. And, you know, one thing I picked up from you is that, or maybe it was Alan, that they have a program, labor does, union leaders do, but they don't seem to want to fight for it, right? They just talk from this point on and say the right things, whether it's community alliances or whatever, and then jump in bed with the Democrats and with management. Jerry, what should be done about this problem of the political strategy? We know the problem. What's the solution?
Well, Jack, I think we have to do three basic things. Educate, organize, and mobilize. Educate because a lot of people in the labor movement haven't even thought in terms of an alternative. They've been so conditioned to the two-party system that there hasn't been much of a challenge to that system mounted. But we've got to show that it's a popular idea. The great majority of population now favors a third party. It can't be a third party to the right, which occurs in some countries when masses of people become so dissatisfied. We have to have a left alternative, a working class alternative. But also, there's spontaneity is key too. And let me give you an example of that. And that's Syria. The government, the Obama administration, was on the brink, as you know, of bombing Syria and involving us in yet another war. But yet, all over the country, whether it was a blue state or a red state or a purple state, people deluged their representatives in Congress saying no. And they had to back away from that. So we're laying a lot of groundwork, planting seeds to help create that kind of climate where people do that kind of thing. If they don't like something, they speak up. So there's a big educational job. As far as organizing, we favor building labor community coalitions around issues that advance the interests of the 99% and have a program and promote independent candidates running for office and breaking with the two-party system. Recently in Ohio, in Lorain, there was a collision between the Democratic Party hierarchy and the trade unionists. They clashed. They couldn't resolve it. Had to do with the election of certain people to the council. So labor went its own way and put up independent labor candidates and won. And won. This shows you the potential. Chicago, we understand that they're considering running independent candidate for mayor. And we hope very much that they will, because we think there would be a great response. So we need to organize these coalitions, and Chicago has been the model in their fight, their valiant and heroic fight to maintain public education and protect teachers' jobs and standards. And so they work very closely with the community groups, and that's how they won their strike. So these things are beginning to happen, and we hope to see them replicated. And as far as mobilizing, I think you put your finger on it, Jack. Labor has a lot of good programs, and they, for example, have taken a strong position, no cuts to Medicare and Social Security, which Obama has proposed, and they haven't wavered on that. But it's selective, and even where they do take good stands, they don't mobilize. They have not called a march on Washington for jobs or to protect safety net programs or a host of other things, single-payer health care. They rather compromise and dilute. And then they urge the affiliates to lobby and maybe to hold a local rally uncoordinated. So those are the three things I would say we have to do. I did want to comment about the other main issue, which is the budget report, or shall I hold that?
We'll hold that. We'll come back to that. I want Alan to have an opportunity to say, well, what do we mean by independent action here on the industrial sphere? In other words, bargaining and strikes and so forth. Alan.
Jack, take what happened with the teachers in Chicago. They were fighting for their contract to keep the schools open, and they built powerful coalitions with the community, the parents. They explained why it was in the interest of the community as a whole to support the teachers, and the teachers weren't just there alone. They had been there and supported the community on their issues. It was a two-way street. They took on the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, who is a right-hand man to Obama. They refused to give in and to capitulate. Their own union leadership came in and tried to negotiate behind the backs of the union, and they said no. This is independence. Our union executive board, our union delegates, our union will make the decisions. No one, Randy Weingarten, nobody at the top is going to make the decisions except for our members, relying on the rank and file, giving them a voice, organizing mass assemblies every day, educating the community, reaching out, building the alliances, and then saying a strong line in the sand, we are not going to capitulate, we're not going to give in. And
Alan,
they went out on strike.
Can you comment on the Chicago situation, the recent strike? What kind of union community structure or organization was set up in Chicago where both the community and the union made joint decisions about how to carry on the fight? To me, it seems that the local organizational structure, when we talk about these alliances and joint fighting at the grassroots, is extremely important. Otherwise, you just have the spontaneous, it happens here and there occasionally, eruptions, but you don't have an ongoing relationship between community and grassroots union folks fighting for each other.
Well, this is what they did. They prepared a year in advance. They began explaining. They began building outreach to the parents and to the community at large. So they couldn't be pitted as a special interest looking out just for themselves at the expense of the community. They showed how the plan to privatize education hurt the community, how this privatization, the closing of schools, the pitting the union against the community was all a big business scheme. And so they built dialogue. They built labor community forums. Then they created labor community coalitions in each neighborhood in the city. And then they had a real ongoing permanent dialogue. Now, mind you, the union didn't dissolve, and this is perhaps where I have a disagreement with you. The union maintained its own structures internally as the same time that it built the outreach and the labor community alliance through the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union. And it had its own union assembly of delegates to be able to determine that they were going to go on strike, but they had set into place the continuous permanent dialogue through these coalitions that functioned through meetings every other day, and on Saturdays people came together in the schools in each of the communities. They had 54 assemblies in Chicago to do this. So it was a permanent structure of a coalition where the community gave its input, what should be done, how do we support the teachers, but the teachers in turn listened to the community and got their feedback saying, yes, we can go for it. They had rallies of 10,000 people. It was the term Jerry uses, mobilization is central. They showed Rahm Emanuel. And this, mind you, was at a time right at August, September 2012, right before the midterm election when you weren't supposed to be out on strike. The union leadership says, we don't want to embarrass Obama. And they said, it's precisely at this time when we have leverage. And they went out, they showed they could do it 7 days on the picket line with the entire community behind them, and Obama caved. Rahm Emanuel and the board caved. They didn't give the union everything they wanted, But it showed what you do when you have resolve, when you listen to your members, when you build community, genuine community alliances, not the token ones, which we've seen so often Labor does, where it handpicks a few people, calls it a Labor Community Alliance, and it doesn't do the outreach, doesn't build the alliance, doesn't build the dialogue. That remains to be done.
Just a comment here on what you've said, and then a question for you, Alan, here, with regard to Boeing, what's going on now. First of all, my position is not that a union should dissolve their organization, especially at the grassroots level. It's not mutually exclusive. In other words, you don't have to dissolve your union organization, and community doesn't have to dissolve its organization, independence and integrity, in order to create a additional joint organizational structure that is ongoing, that the most militant of both community and labor can jointly continue the fight on.
Then
I'll clarify that later, but
I think it's important
that you don't just have a spontaneous here or there eruption, even though it may be successful from time to time, as in Chicago.
Absolutely.
But let me ask you this, Alan, how would you take
for labor to build those alliances?
As a real
ongoing, permanent part of our work as the unions. The unions represent, 10-11% in the private sector?
Private sector,
8%,
less than
7-8%.
Less than 7% now in the private sector.
That's exactly.
Public sector about 30, but it's under attack.
Exactly.
Yeah, but Alan, take this question here. How would you translate the positive successes of labor community action in Chicago to the Boeing situation?
Well, I think the first thing that would have to be done is to say the strategy of the labor movement in the state of Washington is misguided. They've created a coalition of labor unions at Boeing Club that is essentially saying to Boeing, please don't leave. We'll play nice. You need us. We need you. And it's calling on the governor to make further tax exemptions and concessions, incentives for the company to stay. No, what labor should be doing is to say, and there could be a resolution passed by the King County Central Labor Council saying, we support the rank and file union members who at Boeing said, we're not going to give in to the blackmail of the corporation. Labor has the right to stand up for its rights, for its demands, and to vote down a concessionary contract. And therefore, it's up to labor to stand in solidarity, build solidarity with these sisters and brothers at Boeing who said, we have to defend our contract. Because if labor does not defend its contracts there, it's going to be a continued race to the bottom.
Well, what does that mean, stand in solidarity, though, with the Boeing workers?
Tell Boeing that they're not just dealing with a local rank and file at Boeing in Washington. They're dealing with the entire labor movement in the state of Washington, and that we're going to take action. Strike action, mobilize, strike. We're going to demand, and we're going to say that we all stand behind these workers, first thing, to show power of the labor movement and the community, there are hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's not just the 27,000 jobs, but it's all of the subsidiary jobs that are built in to the whole communities. If that company were to leave and build the 777s elsewhere, that's tens and tens and tens of thousands of jobs that are lost. It's entire Rust Belt areas in the state of Washington. And say, if necessary, we're going to demand and we're going to mobilize that the state prevent, that the governor, and we're going to call on the politicians to demand that if they were to leave, the state will use the right of eminent domain and take over. They're not going to have the right to leave.
This is Jerry.
We're not going to allow this more, this blackmail, this whipsawing anymore.
Yeah. Can I,
Jerry, jump in. Go ahead, Jerry. We got two minutes.
I want to interject on Boeing by saying I think the solidarity has to be national in the labor movement. Anytime Boeing looks at another site, there has to be a movement by labor in that site to resist. South Carolina, for instance, there's a big objection because they're broke, like most states, and yet they're offering big incentives to come to South Carolina. And if the solidarity is evident in Missouri, any place that Boeing looks at, labor's got to track it down, and the whole national labor movement should be behind these Boeing workers in Washington.
That's correct. That's key, Jerry. We are all Boeing workers in Seattle. We're not going to let them move
and
here.
Where does the community come into the struggle? Now, you obviously mentioned, Alan, that there's a lot at stake for other jobs elsewhere in the community, but where's the structure for uniting the community in this fight in Boeing and Washington?
Well, take the state of Washington. There's a very strong Jobs with Justice movement.
Okay. I'm sorry, Alan. We'll leave that with Jobs for Justice. That's a good point, and it suggests where some future discussion on this show will occur with regard to workers' centers as community organizations here. Is labor really taking full advantage of that possibility?